My name is Lloyd Peckle Jr. I'm the host for the Arctic Science Sessions, a podcast made in partnership with the National Science Foundation and Battelle Arctic Research Operations. Today we talk with Jackie Grubmeier and her team of oceanographers on the importance of understanding our ocean, how oceanographers collect data, and why being at sea is so fulfilling.
Yeah, hi, I'm Lee Cooper. I work at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Solomons, Maryland.
Jackie Grubmeier. I also work at the Chesapeake Biological Lab, which is part of the University of Maryland Center of Environmental Science.
And I'm Mark Razan, working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage.
And I'm Nick Silverson. I'm a first-year master's student with Jackie and Lee at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science.
Nice. Well, it's nice to meet you guys. Thanks for coming. I'm very excited about this podcast. I've heard a lot about Lee and Jackie.
I sailed famous. With.
Yep, they are famous. I think
Mark is also famous. I think.
Yeah. I just gotten off a cheap science training cruise where I met your employee.
Christina Gaethel. She's a new PhD graduate.
Yeah, we can't say she's our student
anymore. But yeah. She's our postdoc.
Okay, yeah. That's where I met her, and she always talked about the Lee Cooper and Jackie. So, yeah, I heard a lot about you guys. You guys just got off the Sir Wilfrid Laurier. Is that, did I say that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. It's a Canadian Coast Guard cutter.
Okay.
The Sir Wilfrid Laurier. And we do this annual cruise as part of the Distributed Biological Observatory, which is a national and international looking at time series sites from the Northern Bering Sea up to Tiavik. And an extension to the eastern part of the Beaufort.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we take advantage of this ship. It's based in Victoria, British Columbia, and it has to sail through Alaskan waters anyway to get to their mission. They do buoy tending and channel markers and things like that in the Canadian Arctic. And so we hitch a ride every year, and it's cost effective in that they're coming this way anyway. So we just pay for the ship time through National Science Foundation funds for the time that they spend helping us with their science. So it's really cost effective way to sample in this area that's so remote.
Three weeks ago we left Victoria and traveled 3,500 miles to be here with you today.
Oh, well, thank you. how was the journey?
Excellent. Amazingly flat. It was really calm most of the time. A little bit fog, a little bit rain, but the seas were extremely well behaved for the Bering Sea.
And you sailed as the marine mammal?
I'm the marine bird observer.
Marine bird observer, okay.
And marine mammal observer, yes.
Yeah, and I would just say that, this program, the DBO, is collaborative with our Canadian colleagues, specifically for this cruise. So working out of the University of Victoria, our Institute of Ocean Sciences. And so they do a lot of zooplankton work, little plankton that live in the water column, and they do the physical oceanography, temperature, salinity, currents. I'm a biological oceanographer, so we'll talk about that stuff later. But I just want to make sure it's an international program. And so there's another ship coming up called the Korean, the Aeron, and they will do some sampling on our observing lines, as well as the Japanese, the Mirai, which oftentimes people see off here because they change out, I believe. And they also are occupying some of these lines. And then we compare these data sets, so we get a seasonal look.
Okay. I'd like to talk about the DBO specific. Well, actually, maybe we should kind of define what a line is for people who may not know much about how marine research is done.
Well, one of the things we're interested in is how, of course, the system is changing. And so we do what we call transect lines and stations. A station is simply you stop the ship and you make a bunch of measurements, and then we put those all in a line so we can plot that later. And the Bering Strait region, which we say is everything from up here to Utqiagvik, down south to St. Lawrence Island, that there's a lot of interesting things happening, of course, as the sea ice disappears. And so we occupy these same stations. That is, we stop the ship the same place every year, and then we're trying to follow what's happening in the ecosystem. And the international nature of this is that lots of countries are sending their ships through Bering Strait. So China has their ship up here now. Korea's ship is coming. The Canadian ship that we use, the Healy, is offshore right now. A lot of these ships occupy these same station, so we've shared information on where they are and what we'd like. And the reason we pick these stations too is that they're very productive. It's a lot of organisms down there, so we put a trawl or a Van Veen grab on the bottom of the ocean, and we'll pull up hundreds of clams. And so we're interested in that base of the food web, things that are feeding on the bottom of the ocean.
Okay. And do you think either of you can touch on the history of this DBO? Is DBO the bigger project or?
Right. It's a network basically. It actually started. We've been doing Lee and I have been sampling here for over 30 years, different projects at National Science Foundation, NOAA, both Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Shell, whatever, looking at status and changes of the ecosystem in total. So what plant life there is and what's influencing food for bowhead whales, the zooplankton, or for the amphipods on the bottom of the ocean that are important for gray whales, or the clams that are important for walruses. So those kind of tie into a lot of the animals people see around here. But what happened is we had a meeting particularly even before the DBO in Washington, where the USGS got up and said, for example, we saw all these spectacled eiders. They had little tags on them, and one of them came and they flew out there and found out that there are hundreds of thousands of these birds south of St. Lawrence Island, and they had no idea why they were there. They were there mainly to look at the ice. And then I gave my talk, and I said, because it's the most productive clam basin in the northern part of the Bering Sea. And so that started back, that was back in the 90s, I think.
Yes, yeah.
And then so we started moving north as that kind of the ice retreated, and we have the capabilities, whether it be a regular ship, ice strengthened, or icebreaker. So we were sampling in sites, and then we started to see these changes in the 90s. We had a meeting in, I think it was in Ottawa. And this part of this Pacific Arctic group. So there's six nations involved with a kind of regional studies here for science. That's the Canada, U.S., China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. So all six of those countries we would meet. And at that time, we said, what can we do together to track these, take advantage of these vessels going through? And so we said, okay, who's doing what where? We made a matrix and what we call a heat map. So how many X's do we put in one quadrant? And figured out, okay, everybody does temperature and salinity, currents. We do chlorophyll that looks at the plant life, nutrients, and then who's doing zooplankton, water, and then all of a sudden we had like a program that if we agreed that we would share that data, we could look at it seasonally and interannually. Yet no country can pay for all of that one access, you know. So that was one of the things we started, and then we had an agreement and under this Pacific Arctic group, and we all went back to our nations to get the money to be able to do this type of study. And then part of what we do too is that we talk with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, you know, about when we're coming up there, try to bring back to the community. So we've had presentations at schools here in Utqiagvik. COVID didn't help a lot of that, but we have met with elders and seniors and whaling captains and so forth over the years. So that's basically how it started, is that countries started seeing we have these vessels. We as scientists said, well, can we then find a way that we could work together more and share that data so we can get a lot more than one point during the season? And the other thing that happens under the observing program, so we're doing physical, chemical, biological, is to put moorings in the sea. So we can look at temporally over the years, so the temperature looking under ice cover, that information, sounds for marine mammals. So that's work that's being done like for Kate Stafford. Sue Moore is a marine mammalogist that we've worked with in the past. I could go on with names, but you don't need to. But the main thing to see is that we do a variety of things. Gliders, there's gliders that come out. So we try, there's a lot of assets by different funding agencies. And what the DBO is trying to bring them together, like NASA, our space agency, has a landing page. So if people wanted to go into Google and put DBO NASA, they would come up and they start seeing real-time satellite information on chlorophyll, the currents, seawater temperature. So that is the interagency connection, and then we built that up over the years as part of the DBO.
Okay.
And I just add that we call it a distributed biological observatory because we're observing things. It's distributed because we're counting on all these other countries, all these other agencies, even within the United States, to chip in, help where they can. So Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, provides bird and marine mammal observers for our cruises. So that's funding that comes from that source. And so everybody has a little bit of skin in the game, so to speak. And it's biological because the changes are challenging to observe. We, you know, from satellites, from lots of distant sensors, we know that the ice is disappearing. We know the water temperature is getting warmer. How does that affect the ecosystem, the animals that people hunt, say, here on the North Slope Borough? Those are the kinds of things we're interested in addressing. And it's actually much more complicated to document changes in the biological system. You actually have to come and do the sampling every year at some of the same places where it's biologically productive. So that's the DBO in a nutshell. The idea is, it has proven successful enough that people are, well, we like people copying us. So there's a DBO being developed in the Atlantic near Svalbard, between Svalbard and Greenland. There's another one being developed in the Davis Strait, Baffin Bay area of Canada. And we recently went to Korea to help the Koreans and some American scientists develop another DBO that'll be further north from here, basically north of Russia, but outside of the Russian exclusive economic zone in the East Siberian Sea. So it's an idea that seems to have some interest, yeah, and resonating with other scientists around the world.
And I would just add that when we come up on the Laurier, or when we'll be back on the Sikuliak in the fall period, is that we stop here in Utsjoki, and usually we do in the sampling from what we call DBO-1 down by the Northern Bering Sea, south of where there's a Polynya. And so we put these lines in productive areas that are latitudinal. So we're moving up the ladder, you know, as you go north to Utsjoki. Well, then the ladder doesn't go up anymore that we do on shelf, because most of these animals, they stay on the shelf or on the slope. It goes eastward. So we put in new DBO lines in 6, 7, and 8 over into Canadian waters. So the Canadians do a lot of do the sampling, particularly over Bathurst Polynya. So that kind of compares with the St. Lawrence Island Polynya. So there's a compare and contrast going on, because the gray whales are feeding over there, whereas mainly it's the eiders down south of St. Lawrence Island. So different Polynya system, open water and ice-covered sea, and how that is really changing with the warming. It's actually quite dramatic, because, as you know, last in the 18 and 19, we had no sea ice really south of St. Lawrence, and then those commercial fish started going north.
And you guys are experienced oceanographers, right? Maybe you guys can give like a quick, like, basic, you know, oceanography 101. Like, these are the tools. This is, you need to know these certain aspects of the ocean to do your science. Like, you need to collect this certain data to do your science. It's like, I've sailed as an observer twice, and I kind of had to learn as I go,
right,
like, what a CTD is, what a Van Veen is. So perhaps you can just give a quick rundown of what oceanography is to someone who may not know.
Yeah, I think a good way to start this, we'll give you what a standard station. So we leave and get to our first station, and we stop the ship. And the first thing we put down is on this particular vessel is an instrument that can look at the current speed. So it's sitting in the water while we're sitting, starting what is our quote station, last couple hours. And then the next thing it goes in is this instrument called the CTD. Looks at conductivity, gives you salinity, temperature, and then you need to know the depth. And at that point, I'm going to give it to Lee, because then there's the water column measurements that his team does.
Well, yeah, there's a what we call a rosette. So there's a bunch of bottles that are open when they go down. They're attached to the CTD. There's other sensors on there, too. There's a fluorometer to give you an electronic measurement of chlorophyll. There's these are adaptable. You can put lots of different things on these CTDs. The main thing is we're measuring that's salinity and the temperature and the depth, and that tells you how the ocean is structured. And then everything else you add to that. And it is a biological observatory that we're involved in, so we have to make the physical measurements to understand the context of the biology that we observe. So these water bottles will be measured for nutrients, so things that plants need for photosynthesis.
The water inside the bottle.
Yeah, inside these bottles. So the bottles get closed at different depths. They're closed electronically. by a push of a button on a computer screen. We'll measure chlorophyll, nutrients, and some other things of interest. And then we'll bring it back up and get that water out of the bottles. And at, and the next thing that happens on the deck, in another part of the deck on the Laurier, is we do some zooplankton sampling for these little animals that feed on the phytoplankton. So the phytoplankton are the plants, the zooplankton, like a zoo, or zooplankton are the animals. So we want to know who's eating the plants at the first level in the food web. So that would include the things like the krill that end up getting fed on by the whales. And then we're really interested in what's on the bottom. And up here in Alaskan waters, there's so much continental shelf. It's the Bering and the Chukchi Seas are the largest continental shelf that the United States has ownership or control of. So it's shallow and it's productive, and so a lot of the material falls to the seafloor, and it feeds a lot of things on the bottom. So clams and tunicates and everything that's down there, amphipods, crabs, all of these things on the bottom, and even we see fish on the bottom that depend on the food on the bottom. So we do sampling of the sediments, and we want to know what's the chemistry of the sediments as well as what's in it. So we use this Van Veen grab, which is just a big mud scooper that's of a specific size, so we can say there's so many clams per square meter, and we use the metric system, of course, in science. So we'll bring those four Van Veen grabs up. We do four, so it's statistically robust. We can say, well, it's four plus or minus, it's, you know, so many clams per meter squared plus or minus some number. So we have a statistical basis for comparing. Is it more than last year? And we also take these organisms home. We preserve them in formaldehyde and then have people back in the lab, including Nick and Brian, analyzing the organisms and figuring out what species do we have, how much do they weigh, so we can say how much food is there on the bottom that these organisms can eat. And at the same time, we take a look at the sediments and say, well, what's the grain size? How much chlorophyll is on the sediment surface itself that's food for the animals in there? Other things like the carbon nitrogen ratios tell you how fertile it is, and I could go on and on. Yeah. But I that's enough. That's a station. We do the camera as part of this on the Laurier, but and there are other things that other analyses.
Yeah, and then what in the in between, Mark is having coffee while we're doing on station, but in between he's doing his work all the way from morning to night when it's light, which is almost all the time up here. And so you can say what you do.
So once all the water work is done and the boat comes back up to speed, I start my job, and I'm surveying a quarter of the vision of the forward movement, and counting all the birds and marine mammals out to 300 meters in 50 meter bins, and identifying them, finding their numbers, finding their behaviors, and simultaneously putting them into a computer which has a current GPS feed. The purpose for that is to determine how many birds there are per square meter over a transit, which is typically between stations, but as we were coming up from Victoria, it was pretty much continuous. And so I would add, in addition to the DBO, the Fish and Wildlife Service has been conducting transects whenever a ship is at sea with an observer for about 50 years. And so we have track lines everywhere in the Pacific that go into the North Pacific Seabird Database of all the birds and marine mammals that have been seen over the last half century. And so that's a different set of data. But we've now been integrated with the DBO and taking advantage of this platform of opportunity.
Yeah, and one thing he also looks at when he recognizes marine mammals on there, he's able to do that collection. On our Sekuliak cruise that we'll have in September and October, we'll have a dedicated seabird and a marine mammal, because that's really written. A lot of animals are coming back into the system. And I don't think that was interesting to me this year was normally we see lots of gray whales. We saw how many?
I saw about four six on transect.
That's an all-time low.
So the interesting thing is I'm not always watching, and I can only count for a small portion of the view. So I think overall I looked at my data, about 20 other whales were seen by the crew going, oh, there's a blow, there's a fluke. Right. We didn't identify them. So, and then I got about 15 on my transect. So You know, 35 whales is not a lot.
No, it's not a lot, because having, you know, I've been doing this for decades, you know, as I've been reminded by Christina when she wants to talk to me about that, which is the person who's giving you questions, Christina Gaethel. But there are lots of gray whales. When I was doing my PhD at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, in the Chirikoff Basin, they weren't that many in the Chukchi at that time. There was a lot just south of St. Lawrence when this really salty, cold, what we call Anadir water goes. And then you go north, and that was their breadbasket, really, for those gray. And then they've been going north. But I was surprised. I mean, I always see gray whales, and this year was very, very, very strange about that. And I know the bowheads will start coming back in the fall, so maybe they're delaying their migration north. I'm not sure. We'll find out more. And, you know, there's been an unusual mortality event for grays the last couple of years. They still look like they had a lot of gray. They've come back after the whaling part. And stranded seabirds were something that happened. I don't think we saw that many floating birds this time, but the last couple of years was really a lot of bird die-offs.
I saw no dead birds, but what I did see is very few birds. So the consequences of those die-offs, I think, are apparent.
Okay.
The shearwaters that were once, like the gray whales, an indicator of the abundance of these two systems, the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea, are virtually gone. So while you didn't see gray whales, I didn't see many shearwaters.
Okay.
And I started out in 1975 doing the same type of cruise, so this is almost a 48-year return. And going through the Unimak Pass 48 years ago was astounding. Thousands, literally millions of shearwaters and whales and sea lions. And I saw single-digit sea lions and hardly any shearwaters. So yeah. You know, we have this data, but we also, you know, so
we have
Christina
some age.
Shouldn't be putting you down for your vision. she should be honoring you.
Because, no, thank you.
You have this perspective. We have this perspective that I'm looking here at a chart that's talking about the shifting baseline. You know, our baseline was like the Serengeti Plain of the Bering Sea. You know, Nick's baseline is what he saw on this cruise. So when he's here with you 50 years from now, what will his baseline, how will his recollections reflect what is really real? So this long-term data set is crucial.
So we're coming up on an hour of podcast. Is there anything you'd like the general public to know about what you do, or just features about the sea, put them at comfort, at ease, or anything like that? Or maybe talk about something we didn't touch on just yet?
Well, you know, everything we do is paid for by the taxpayers, so we want to express our appreciation. I mean, sometimes I feel like I can't believe people are paying me. I'm being paid to do this when you're out there and having this experience. But we're also trying to return that knowledge, understand how the Arctic is changing with climate and how it's affecting people who live here in the Arctic, as well as people in the rest of the United States and the rest of the world. So we're really appreciative of the support we receive from the National Science Foundation, NOAA, all of the other agencies that provide support, and you know, in ancillary ways too, to have Fish and Wildlife Service step up and provide people to come and I'm very impressed with Mark's expertise with looking up in the sky and, oh no, that's what that duck is or that bird is, or he doesn't even need binoculars sometimes. So thank you for joining us on this cruise, and I thank our two graduate students too who are here in the room, and everybody else who was with us too.
Yeah, and I would just ditto that. I mean, it is something to be able to. These decades have been going out. It's the funding, but it is the tax day dollars at work, you know. But I also appreciate the trying to convey. And I would like feedback from the community of things that they would be interested in too, conveying and ways to convey that better than you know, newsletters or going to the schools. We used to have been doing that in the past. So feedback is a good thing. You know, so if we have an opportunity to have, you know, either out of the ship or to come into the shore or to come back, we've been back here in the wintertime too. That's when we can go into the schools. The schools are great because especially the young kids, because they don't have any inhibitions of asking any questions. And then we have the communities in the evening, you know. So I think that part of it, that I think there's a lot more interchange going on now than I first started my career. And in that part, I think it's a really healthy thing, be it the agencies working together and the scientists spending more time talking to each other and working with the communities. I think if all of that is advancing forward, and we're in a changing period. So I think that part of it, a lot of great memories. Some, you know, there's been some stressful time, but I think keeping open communication would be the thing I'd like to continue on doing.
Okay.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on the changing communities, because I wonder, how do we all think and process all this change? You know, so much is happening so fast. For your local communities, it's more than food. It's a livelihood that's been consistent for thousands and thousands of years. For every human, it's watching something that they thought they knew that was stable, not being stable. And it's really almost difficult to talk about how psychologically we begin to conceive of a new order where everything is unpredictable. And, you know, I think of any listener, I wonder how do you process that? And I'm curious about it, because I have no idea. And I just want to keep bringing that up. And it's, I know it's not a happy thing to think about, but it's what our school kids are facing. It's what, and not just here, it's everywhere. So these are serious times, and no one's really sure where we're going to land.
And one thing I would say, too, is, I mean, although we're looking at contaminants and harmful, it's a healthy ocean still. You know, that's the thing.
Yeah.
But it's also, but there's warning, little warning signs going on. And we need many eyes looking at and many viewpoints to look at that, so we can kind of give some how to move forward in that situation. Because, you know, the weather, we can't control it. Well, we could control the weather a little better, and then we could talk about climate change, and we're not going to go into that details. But I think that's the thing, is that we need to be positive but constructive in evaluating, and be realistic about where things are going, and keeping that open communication, I think, is a really important part of that.
Thank you for listening. I really enjoyed my conversation with Jackie and Lee. I love being at sea, so this had to be one of my favorite episodes. This is the Arctic Science Sessions, a podcast created in partnership with the National Science Foundation and